Okay, the question that came about in the box this morning, of all Jesus' miracles, which do you believe was the most life-changing and why? Well, first of all, what is a miracle? How do you... Okay, something out of the ordinary. Well, that's part of the question. The most life-changing and why? Life-changing for whom? Life-changing for the person to whom it happened? Life-changing for his family or life-changing for us? That was important for a lot of folks there. But, you know, how do we describe a miracle? Something that's unexplainable. Something that happens greatly. John Tulloch, in the book on the Old Testament, as he's approaching, looking at various miracles in the Old Testament, defines miracle as any activity, explainable or not, which when seen through the eyes of faith, strengthens the faith of the believer. One of the first things we need to remember about miracles is that to label an event a miracle requires faith in God. It requires us to have some faith in God, to believe that it's more than just some unexplainable wonder. Rather, God is present in that unexplainable wonder, or even something that we can explain. God is present there, acting in history in some way that is beyond what we could have expected, what we could have imagined. Okay. Well, and really, if you look at the biblical text, and if you accept that in faith, there were miracles surrounding his birth, surrounding his life, surrounding his death, surrounding his resurrection. Those things take faith, do they not? Faith in God and faith that God was present, faith that God was doing something in history through Jesus. And if you really think about it, with what God was doing in and through Jesus in that particular way, that could be seen as the greatest miracle because of what God has done for us through Jesus that is life-changing, or is supposed to be life-changing. But then when we start talking about the specific miracles that Jesus performed, the first one recorded in the Gospel of John, water into wine. Well, actually, Baptists can go one even better. We change wine into Welch's. That's right. Well, if he leaves it sitting around, then it starts going sharp. No hocus pocus or anything. He just said, fill up the jars with water. Now draw some off and take it to the chief wine steward. And the chief wine steward tasted it and he said, ho. He went over to the bridegroom and said, usually people serve decent wine till everybody gets two or three sheets in the wind. And then they bring out all the rot gut stuff. He said, but you saved the best for last. So, and what does that miracle say? Well, it speaks to things on a lot of different levels, does it not? Jesus wasn't wanting to do that miracle. And by the way, miracles are signs from God, and especially in the Gospels, especially in the Gospel of John. Miracles are referred to not as miracles, they're referred to as this was the first of his signs. This was the second of his signs. They were signs that God was present. Okay? Family. I mean, how's he going to turn mama down? Yeah. But family relationships. And who knows? Now, I listened to a guy one time, just shook my head. He was delivering a paper in one of these publisher parish. You know, one of the things, a lot of colleges and universities out there, it's a publisher parish world. If you want to get tenure, if you want to get promotions, if you want to get decent raises, that kind of thing, you have to publish books or articles or deliver papers. And I have sat through at some professional meetings a lot of those publisher perish papers. And you know they are simply because they're so ridiculous. But like the guy who was going to prove conclusively that the star in the east was actually Halley's Comet. And Jesus was not born around 6 to 4 B.C., but rather was born in 12 B.C. because that was the recorded time when Halley's Comet came through. He didn't have any other evidence other than the fact that Halley's Comet came through at that time, and he thought that it might have been. But that's one of those publisher perish papers. The
Jesus lived to be 34, so not 35 or
34. But the another one of those publisher perish was had to do with the guy who was there, and he said that the reason Jesus was at that wedding was because it was his own. Well, if you read the text, Jesus was invited to the wedding. He and his disciples were invited, and the only kind of wedding I know that you're invited to if it's your own is at the end of a shotgun. But it may have been a family member, which might have shown Mary's concern even more so. Because back then you didn't just do the reception. You had relatives that would travel in and they would stay up to a week, and you were expected to provide places to stay and food and drink for them for the whole time they're there. Whether you liked your in-laws or not.
Makes you appreciate it.
Or the outlaws, yeah. But Jesus acted taking care of family concerns. He also acted to keep from embarrassing. And really it was seen as a curse to run out of food or wine at the wedding festivities. But what else does it say about Jesus? And not only what he promises to do and the expectation he has from his followers. What did the wine steward say? You saved the best for last. In other words, Jesus in that action was also showing those disciples and few others who were around, I'm going to do the very best for you. But also, he expects nothing less than our best. Yes, Susan. Right, cursing the fig tree, calming the storm.
Were all those because of what someone else wanted? I don't think the fig tree is. But
no, the fig tree was not.
Calming the storm, that was because
the disciples were
afraid. Yeah. He wouldn't have done that without them needing it.
Right.
And the feeding, the thousands, I mean, that was a need.
That was a need. It was those kinds of things were in response to a need.
Yes.
And he to meet the need. He was not doing it to show up. He didn't want to literally play Caesar's Palace. Da, 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 da.
These were
kind of
like things that it
wasn't
like, this is my idea and I'm going to do this and I'm going to show the world. He didn't really necessarily, like you said, want to do the water and the wine. But these were things that he did.
He did it because of the need.
And feeding the thousands.
But even in that, and in doing those things, he shows protection. He shows that he is there.
So
like the prayer says, it's a response. Yes, those are. Now, miracles of healing in the Synoptic Gospels, the miracles of healing are always in response to somebody else showing faith. They're not to elicit faith. So once again, that's a need, but that need, someone has come to him showing faith. Anyway, I believe that you can heal me, the leper says. And the woman touches the centurion whose servant is ill to the point of death. And Jesus says, well, let's go. And he says, well, you don't have to go. I'm over all these soldiers, and when I say something, they do it. All you have to do is say the word. And Jesus praises him for his faith, and your servant's healed. He goes, and his men meet him and say, hey, he's up, walking around, everything's fine. And they said, well, about when did that happen? And when they told him, it was the same time Jesus sent him. The Syrophoenician woman, or the Canaanite woman, whose daughter had the demon and comes to him, and you know, he says, but I didn't come to the dogs. And she said, yeah, but even the house dogs get to eat the crumbs. And he praises her faith and says that that faith has healed her daughter. The four guys that upset whoever it was, some have said it was Peter's household. Others No, it was somebody else, but they came and they brought the friend and they couldn't get close. And so they go up and they tear a hole in the roof and lower him down. Jesus heals in response to their faith that he can do something. Well, the water to wine, there were not very many around. There were just a few of the disciples. And the folks who filled up the six jars that each held 20 to 30 gallons. So it's a pretty big wedding when you figure he made between 120 and 150 gallons.
Yeah, but I mean, those who knew that he had done this deed.
But they knew something was going on. God was with him. Somehow he was doing this because he didn't do some mumbo jumbo over it. He just said, fill it up, all right? And they wanted to make sure if something could be done that they got every bit, because it says if they filled it all the way to the brim in every jar. They drew it off. There wasn't any kind of strange waving of his hands or any special formula, that kind of thing. They believed in him, but they didn't believe in him as Messiah. They believed in him as a miracle worker, a wonder worker. You've got all those others, and the raising of Jairus' daughter. And he goes in and says, Talitha kumi, little girl, arise or get up. And then he says, now don't tell anybody what happened. Well, it's kind of tough. She was dead. She walks out alive, but that's not what he meant. What he meant was, don't tell them what happened, as in, this is what I did and this is what I said, because people might think, we'll take this on the road and we'll use these words and make a whole bunch of money and stuff. Yes.
It's a different kind of thing, and that's always really kind of puzzled me, because is there really a demon in him, or is it like an emotional, psychological, intellectual?
Yeah, or disease.
Depends on who you listen to. There are folks who say yes, they were actual demons from Beelzebub and from the devil, because he has his minions, and they don't run around little yellow guys with single eyes or whatever. But he has his minions, those who work for him. Then there are some people who say that, for example, the Gadarene or Gerasene, depending on which account you're reading, it's either the Gadarene demoniac or the Gerasene demoniac, that he casts them out and throws them into the pigs. There are folks that say the fits seem an awful lot like epilepsy. And people might have thought he had a demon, but he might have had epilepsy. There are others it depends on who all you're talking to or listening to. There are others who say, well, there were other mental disorders that would account for those things, and his spirit and his presence calmed that person, not just at that point, but for the future. Which even in itself, even if that were the case, to do that for the person in that moment, suddenly and for the future, is a rather miraculous cure.
Well, not just
Catholics. There are some Protestants who do. There are some Lutherans that do. And I just flip the channel every now and then, but there was last year sometime, I think, there was going to be an exorcism that was going to be broadcast, and it was from a Pentecostal perspective. But it was cast out and sent. It was supposedly cast out and sent back to hell, from whence it had come. So, but Roman Catholics do. That is a part of all of that. There are folks who are set aside to be exorcists, and they are the ones that are called. In fact, every large parish is supposed to have an EOC, exorcist on call. In all of that.
I know we've got many different types of Baptist religions, but what part, per se, does believe in the exorcism on the Baptist Protestant side?
I really don't know, other than just individuals here and there. I was trying to call up the guy's name. But 2 or 3 years ago, there was a Baptist minister. He wasn't a Southern Baptist minister or a CBF minister. He was an independent Baptist minister somewhere out Oklahoma-ish, Missouri-ish, that kind of thing. Yeah, but Ernest was not Baptist, but yes. Ernest, who said he could heal you through the TV screen. Now send your tithes and offerings and let us know that you felt the Spirit move and all these sweaty palms against the TV screen with a static electricity. But you know, there are folks, a girl that I dated back right after I graduated high school, the one whose father had the pool table, and she, and they were Assemblies of God. And their minister believed that he could cast demons out of people. He could see demons in people and cast them out. He never came close to me, so I don't know. I don't know if mine scared him or not, but he believed, but that was more from a Pentecostal. Assemblies of God's in that whole Pentecostal mode, with the Spirit, et cetera. And one of the reasons when we talk about gifts of the Spirit, one of the reasons that Paul says, and typically it's taught that if one supposedly has that gift, even if you do it in private, you should pray that God would allow you to be able to interpret and understand what you're saying, is because the question is, how do you know that you're praising and not cursing? Because out there, folks who believe strongly in that would say, but that is one of the most easily counterfeited gifts that the devil could use. So instead of praising, you could be cursing. That's why one should pray to have that. But back to these miracles, you know, Jesus, as it's recorded, and even Luke talks about these kinds of miracles, and Luke was a physician. Luke was a man of research and science. And yet Luke gives, really in some ways, a more glowing and convincing argument for virginal conception, which we talk about, we label it virgin birth, but if you don't have a virginal conception, it's just another birth. Then does Matthew. And yet Luke records these things, and Jesus casts out demons, and those demons recognize him. Later on, early on, they speak up, and then he tells them to be quiet. Later, the text in various places will say, and this person had a demon, and he forbid the demons to speak about him. And then he cast them out. But in the Gospel of Mark, they're standing room only, and he's teaching in the synagogue, and the guy comes running in and says, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." And at that point, Jesus commands the spirits to be quiet and then to come out of him. So they speak first, they recognize him. And so that was understood as an exorcism. But simply by his speech. When exorcisms happen, they're always done in the name of Christ.
But you just don't hear about it.
But you don't. No, and really in a lot of places, even within the Roman Catholic Church, they don't like to publicize the thing. You know, you got the stories about the Ouija boards, and there was one years ago. You know, the urban myths that the person was working with a Ouija board and the spirit jumped into him and took him over and they had to call an exorcist and that kind of thing. But, you know, Linda Blair's story was supposed to have been actually based on an actual account. There's supposed to be some other movie coming out. I saw a trailer for it a couple of weeks ago that is supposedly based on...
The Conjuring?
Might be. It says it's based on a true story. Why? That you never know when it says based how loosely they're basing it.
But you know, I worry about young people that watch those kind of movies.
Turn it off.
Big screen and big theaters, and they go and watch it. I mean, that feels wrong to me.
Yeah.
It feels like it's bad. You know, put that.
Well, and then especially with possibilities or people who then turn around and act out.
Thank you.
Because there are folks that do. But then you had every year or two, there'll be some, I remember about 2 years ago now, I think, some woman, and maybe it was longer, up around Chicago, butchered one of her children because she said he had a demon. She had to, and she was told by the spirit she had to cut out his heart to release the demon.
I thought there was one of the women that on fire with the
children. Well, they come up every so often. I don't know. Biblical text says that we do fight a battle against not just those things that we see, but things that are unseen. And that there are powers and principalities out there. When it talks about powers and principalities, it's not just in Romans 8, it's not just talking about the principalities as in the Roman province and all those kinds of things. It's talking predominantly about spirits. Evil spirits. They were directing a wedding yesterday and they read Romans. Of course, I don't know what translation they read it from because I was waiting for it to say. In Romans 8:31-39, that's a passage where it says we're being killed all day long. And whatever translation they had didn't talk about that. And I thought that's an odd passage to be reading it. That's also the one, nothing can separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus. I thought that was an odd passage to be reading in a wedding. So, miracles. Miracles are to be understood, whether explainable or not. You know, I think it's miraculous. The birth of a baby is miraculous. I mean, we know all kinds of things, but the birth of a baby is a miracle. A lot of things that happen through physicians are miraculous.
Kids raised, mother take care of whatever situation. I think a miracle would also be how an animal can have birth and raise it. The mother needs to take over and raise it. That's still a miracle more so because they don't be raised to think we do know.
Well, out of instinct.
Yes.
But the supreme miracle is God coming in Jesus. And all those things that surround. You've got depending on the story. At the crucifixion and resurrection, you got the sky turning dark for hours. You've got the threshold stone being broken in the temple and the temple veil torn in two. You got graves opening up and people walking around. And all kinds of things.
You know that prayer is the Lord give me eyes to see.
Yes.
Because they happen around us all the time.
Yes,
but we don't have eyes to see or ears to hear.
Well, and
whatever reason,
that's true.
But we don't recognize it because we're so accustomed to
just whatever, yeah. and we're so accustomed to science and medicine and all of these other things trying to give answers and explain everything. And yet, even Stephen Hawking, although he tried to retract it about a year and a half ago, even Stephen Hawking. The brilliant mind that he is, and in his history of everything, and he goes back and goes back. He got to a point before he revised his book. He got to a point where he said, "I can get all the way back, but I can't, to what started or to the Big Bang." There's something out there that had to set that off, that had to start it, and he even hinted that it could be a being. Or a force, but he wasn't quite ready to go there.
But all physicists, if they do it long enough, older than Einstein did.
Yes.
All of them, after a period of time of searching and studying, generally come to the place where they say, we'll never understand it.
No, yes. Einstein did that. Albert Schweitzer did the same thing. And Schweitzer eventually comes around and says, he comes to us as one untimely born, and yet we don't understand, and we have to, the end of his books, The Quest for the Historical Jesus, Schweitzer talks about that, and he says ultimately he meets us and we have to recognize that on our own, but we can't do anything more about it, and there's the great illustration about the dominoes, and Aquinas used this one too, about setting up dominoes. And all these patterns you see in the world, but someone had to knock over the first domino. And that someone would be God. Because there are too many patterns. And even in science, people, I'll have students sometimes say, science is Science explains everything. And I'll say, well, have you ever tried to experiment? You've gone every step and you got a different answer, or there was a slight variation in the experiment, in the end result. Yeah, or a mutation, or in, and that right there disproves that science has got it all down because of those variations. Well, in that variation, then you've...
Do you even see that with disease?
Yes. So, what is the greatest miracle in the ministry of Jesus or the life of Jesus? And the most life-changing, and why?
I'd say the resurrection.
Yes,
give me life in my sins.
For us, that crucifixion resurrection, of course. If you go back, though, into Jesus' life, well, you know, it's, and I tell folks, crucifixion, resurrection, and that miracle is just one moment in salvation history. The very fact that he chose to come at all and does come is another moment of salvation history. It didn't just begin that last week. It began with his coming at all. But what would you consider other than crucifixion, resurrection, and Jesus' resurrection on our and the life he gives to us in the ministry of Jesus, what would you consider the greatest and most life-changing? Right.
I think to me the greatest one, and I don't know how other people feel, is the one that he knows your faith. He heals you without you asking him, but you believe so strongly that he is there and he can. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
So that in that gesture where you say, I believe, I'm not going to ask you for this miracle, but I'm going to believe that if I can just get to you, you can give it to me.
And for her, that was very life-changing, but she couldn't stay hidden, could she?
Well, the ones that went through the root line, would they have gone to that much trouble if they weren't?
The faith.
Right, the faith. Or the man with his son.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he throws himself into the fire. He's got the demon, and Jesus said, well, he said, I believe. Help my unbelief. You know, I have faith. I believe, but...
Look at Paul.
Well, and that's what Robert said.
Yeah. Coming from what Paul did now. He's still doing it.
Yeah.
That's what I said 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Right, but. Well, and that is a tremendous life changing, and not just life changing for Paul, but all these folks he came in contact with, and yes, even today, because I would agree with a lot of folks that as far as the theology of the church and the way the church functions, Paul has more to do with it than Jesus. Well, even after Paul, because a lot of the liturgy, the communion liturgy from 1 Corinthians 11, that wasn't set like that until Paul's influence. And even in Romans chapter 6, the baptismal liturgy that is there is more owed to Paul than anything else. But yes, Paul not only hated the Christians, Paul was actually on his way to arrest, persecute, and even kill Christians.
The ones that trouble me the most, the
yes.
miracles that cause me the most angst, are the raising from the dead of people. Because I believe if you really believe there's a heaven and you really believe that's a better place, that
yes,
a family
sir.
Member that wants someone
say
to
it,
die and
it.
Gone on to heaven to come back to this earthly place of struggles, that troubles me. And then Jesus did it and brought them back to life. I'm not saying it's a
right.
bad thing. I can't
well, but,
understand that.
But look at the ones and the belief of the ones. I understand, but the belief of the folks at the time, Jairus and his wife and their only daughter, a young daughter. And in their Jewish belief, at that particular point in time, they were struggling with what happens to that child.
So
and their only child. No. And, you know, and Jesus gives back that life to them at that point. And yet he says, but don't go around and tell everybody all this kind of stuff, because I'm not here just to do it on a whim. You look at the Roman centurion's slave, his servant that he had had for so long, and it was like a family member. And for him, he didn't know what was going to happen to that servant. Yes, there was some kind of afterlife. Yes, he might be experiencing something good, but he didn't know with a slave, he might be experiencing nothing but torment. And you know, he wanted him healed before he died. And that happens. But Lazarus. And in Lazarus, we've got that. That was probably, in some ways, prior to Jesus' own crucifixion and resurrection, that was probably one of the greatest, if not the greatest, miracle he performed, was the raising of Lazarus 4 days after he was dead. No question whatsoever that he was dead, but he did it for folks that he loved. And implicit in both Martha and Mary's initial response to Jesus was the hope, you know, and Martha says, you know, and even now I believe that if you ask God for something, he'll give it to you. Jesus said, well, he'll be raised. She said, yeah, the last day. She was thinking the Yom Yahweh, the day of judgment, because the Pharisees taught the body and spirit would be reunited at that particular point in time. But kind of implied in both of their initial responses, what do they say? She comes out when she hears Jesus is there, and she said, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died. And even now I know that if you asked anything of God, he'd give it to you. And Jesus said, now, don't you believe he'll, you know, he'll, your brother will live again? She said, oh, yeah, at the last day. When Mary comes out, this one who followed him and was supposedly so close and enamored, and Mary comes out, and all she says is, if you'd been here, he wouldn't have died. And she turns her back on him. And so Jesus gives back to them. But in that miracle, and it is that miracle that finally catapults him into that last week with the crucifixion and resurrection. Up to that point, they're just looking to, can we exile him? Can we exile him? Can we run him off? Can we get the people away from him? But when that miracle happens, and I think Jesus knew what the result would be, when that miracle happened, the text says that some of them believed, and others, they beat the world record running the 2 miles from Bethany to Jerusalem. So they could tell Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. And the Sanhedrin at that point begins talking. They're gathering. They say, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And Caiaphas comes in and says, listen, you're nothing but a bunch of dummies. I mean, he really says that. He says, you fools. Do you not know that it is expedient for you that one man should die than that the whole nation should perish? Because they were saying, if we let him keep going on like this, Rome's going to come in, destroy the temple, and we're going to be out on the unemployment line. And that was the final straw that said, we've got to kill him. It's not enough to run him off. We now have to kill him. And so that was a step. And in a lot of ways, that was life-changing. It was definitely life-changing for Lazarus and Mary and Martha. It was life-changing for some of those folks that were there, because the text says some of them believed at that point. But it was life-changing for Mary, because that's Mary, the mother of Jesus, because that's the event that finally pushes it all. It was changing, life-changing for Judas. It was life-changing for all those religious leaders who had him killed. But even more so, it was and is life-changing for anyone who will believe. And unfortunately, it's also a life-changing moment for those who refuse to believe and who scoff. So, I understand your questions and the difficulty with raising those folks from the dead. Then they had to go and do it all over again. That is, die. Right.
So often now you hear about, well, there's a movie about the young boy died. Heaven's for real, where he said died and went to heaven and said,
yeah, but then later he said, wasn't true.
Okay.
But,
not really.
Yes.
Okay, no. I didn't know that.
Yes.
Oh.
I just wonder why did Pastor speak of the same type of situation.
Yeah, no, that.
The other one they've got
daughter and the mother. Is that just all?
Oh, with Jennifer Garner? That I don't know. But the boy who wrote all about that, told all about it, and everything last year sometime came out, and he admitted that he had made it up. But his father was a minister, yes. Yes, but he admitted that he made it up. His father believed him, but he made it up. But like with Lazarus, by the way, according to, we don't have it in the Bible, but according to some of the early church fathers, there's some hints with Lazarus, but according to some of the early church fathers, it changed Lazarus' life in another way, because the religious leadership didn't want to just get rid of Jesus. They wanted to get rid of, and there were plots against Lazarus' life.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And what's the point? You take heroic measures and you bring him back, but he's just bring him back to suffer and die longer. You know, that kind of thing. And so it's also the case that a lot of times too, and especially with modern medicine the way it is, you know, are we playing God? Are we taking that out of the hands of God?
And there are some people who say that we in some ways we are. And I think one of the things is, you know, we look back with all of the modern and postmodern things that are done scientifically and medically and everything else, and we understand more about the disease now than they understood about the disease back then. And so trying to see things through their eyes and with their mindset is very, very difficult. Even when we study those things and we put ourselves in it, and then next thing you know, you flip around and say, oh, but I wouldn't. Why? Because I'm looking at, all of a sudden I step back into my 20th and 21st century world and looking at those things. But I mean, people do. There was a point in time where the average lifespan, I mean, if you were in your mid-30s, you'd lived a long life. Back in Jesus' day, it was rare to live past 40 years old in a lot of the world. If the disciple John is the author of the Gospel of John and the book of Revelation, Gospel of John written somewhere around 90 A.D. and Revelation about 95 to 96 A.D., presuming that he is 20 years old or younger when he begins following Jesus, he's going to be in his 80s by that point in time. That's really a long life back then. But, it's kind of a difficult for us to put ourselves into that, because we do have all of these things, which, and I consider the miracles, as I said this morning, you know, Dr. Young prayed both before David's surgery and when he came out to tell us afterwards, and in both instances, he asked God if God would be with him and work through the skills and the abilities and the knowledge which you, O God, have allowed me to learn. And afterwards, when he came out, he thanked God for working through those skills and those abilities and the knowledge that God had given him. And he said, you're the only one who truly heals. I'm just an instrument that you have trained to use.
So, instead of saying we bring him back up, save the life so they have more difficulties, more pain, maybe they save so they have a better chance to give their life to Christ.
Or make a difference.
Well, you're right, make somebody else's life.
I don't know.
I don't know. I don't have
I know. That's what's
so
hard.
It's so hard.
Well, it's difficult, and
on the operating table, and I believe God let him live for a week for his family to be prepared for his death, because I do not think they would have handled it nearly as well as they did.
I know when my father was on his deathbed, he kept telling us, bring the light closer, bring the light closer. And, you know, I was thinking he was talking about chandeliers, and I didn't recognize it, you know, I'm talking about the brighter light.
Yes, sir.
Well, and there are people who say that we play it in other ways, not just Jack Kevorkian, But when people get the agonal breathing going on and everything's gone except for the brain stem, and somebody says, give them more morphine. Well, what does morphine do? It suppresses the breathing response, which means they're probably going to also die more quickly. Less pain. Well, excuse me, at that point, it's just that. The higher functions are gone. But less sense of agony, less struggling, more peace. We oftentimes we are.
Basically, we see that a dog or a cat or a horse or, you know, fill in the blank is terminal and there is no help for it. We'll say we're not going to put it down. But we will not put it, and I'm not saying we should put a person down. That's not the but we don't know how to do that. I think our relationship with God and with science sometimes really confounds us.
Well, it does, and studies have, well, and yeah, that hospice does help. Studies have been done, too, and I mentioned this a number of weeks ago. We were talking about something that people of faith, Christians, Jews, Muslims in general, tend to be the ones who say, do it all, do everything to keep me alive. And people who lack faith or are part of other world religions where it's vastly different are more likely to say, I'm ready to go whatever, wherever and whatever. So it's really kind of strange that we do that. But in all of that and in the suffering and in what you mentioned a while ago about you wouldn't want your dad to come back in that state. Right. But I come back to the prayer a while ago. Either he will shield you from suffering or give you unfailing strength to bear it. Be at peace then and put aside useless thoughts and vain dreads.
But I do think, too, we have that. That goes back to the Holy Spirit unit we have.
Right.
Because I know my dad said, I'm prepared to die. I'm not ready to leave my family.
Right.
But I'm prepared to die. I mean, he had faith, and he made his own choices not to eat, you know, not to do things. I don't
want
to prolong this and make my family agonize with it.
Right.
But I think that's a personal transaction with God where you get to the place where you say, I'm with God on this. I'm seeking his will in my death. I'm not just hanging on for the hanging on.
And you're sitting in a room with a person for weeks and weeks and weeks, and you're wondering and you're saying, God, why don't you go ahead and take them? And the one time you walk out of the room to talk to somebody or to get a drink from the drink machine down the hall, I think God allows us to have that connection to make those, sometimes make those decisions. Or, you know, and the person, you know of people, maybe even in your own family where, you know, okay, all the family have come and seen and they're still here. And somebody that we may not have even thought they were that close to shows up, visits with them, speaks to them. They take that last breath and go.
Don't anybody that signs like us, we get to live with wheels and all that stuff, not be resuscitated.
Right.
Yeah.
We prove what you can do. Go ahead and go.
Right.
Right. But the greatest miracle has to be God coming in Jesus. But as far as the other miracles, it's the thing that speaks to you. It's the thing that speaks to me. It's the thing that speaks to Ed or to Robert or to Jim or Sarah or Hazel. It's those miracles, even the ones that we read about in the biblical text that Jesus performed, that speak to us and give us a sense of hope and understanding of God. And perhaps touch an area in our life which may even have been similar to those circumstances. Those are probably the most, in answer to the question, I would say those are for you, for me, for each person, the miracles that are the most life-changing. Because they change not only those lives, but they change our lives and our perspectives. The problem is we far too often don't pay that much attention to the miracles. We don't pay that much attention to the ones that are in this. And we certainly don't pay that much attention to the ones that are around us every day.
Well, in John 21:25, it says Jesus did many other things as well, not just the ones we have. So
right.
Obviously, he went around doing miracles right and left. These are just the ones that we have.
Right. These are the ones that we have that folks collected and felt were important and spoke to our human need and our human condition.
You know, it's actually a miracle that we, per se, worship Christ, because we, you know, we wouldn't hear when Jesus Christ walked the earth and all that, but our faith is just strong enough to
see. Oh, the miracle continues. Yeah, he is.
The world population of all the people and how they live in Africa or South America or some of the third world countries where
right.
water's not safe to drink and children are starving in the street, he would say the greatest miracle of his life would be that he were born in America where he has plentiful food and water.
Yeah. So, don't know that we answered that, but we had some good discussion. Thank you all. And may the miracle of tomorrow be with you. Not just tomorrow, but for all the tomorrows that you may have. God bless you and go in peace.